Accession number 27748, Reel 4.
Richard Tsonga, Reel 4.
But it's very interesting from the point of view, you know, watching the land go by on either side, and you can see chaps on camels and, you know, groups of people working in the fields, that sort of thing. It is an interesting trip going through the canal.
But it was very obviously then still a part of the British run operation. I
mean, yes, all the way through. Yes, that's right. And British pilots, you know, on the bridge and that sort of thing. The tugs were had, you know, British officers, but I mean everything, all the work was done by Egyptians, you know, just the chaps in the white uniforms who were British.
And are there any other points of call that stick in your mind?
No, I'd have to go back through, you know, through my old cuttings book to sort of work out the chronological order, but I remember Ceylon was a beautiful place to go to. And so was Japan. We went to some of those shrines, those sea shrines that the Japanese have, you know, built out of huge blocks of wood with the crossbars. And that you often get those very still mornings and evenings, but photographs of those shrines always seem to be, you know, Japan sort of came up exactly as you'd imagine it would be. We didn't see any of the devastation, of course. Yeah, that was good. I enjoyed that commission. When we came back from that, we then went back to Manhattan for our specialist engineering training, which was pretty hard mental work, you know, because after all, a lot of our training had been practical, whereas if you were at a university doing a degree, I don't think there's any practical. You know, you'd be all doing the theoretical stuff, and now we had to cram this theoretical stuff, and, you know, I got pretty well out of my depth, you know. It was really hard work leading up to the final exams. Yeah, that was a very hard time. I didn't enjoy that very much.
And you were still based in Kiev and
No, then we were... We went back to Manhattan, and so we were living in Manhattan, which was an old... Manhattan was a sort of old manor house, and then the grounds had been taken over by the military, and so it had all these huts sort of under the trees standing around, and we used to live in these huts. We had what we called our cabin, which is a little partition of space in it, and you had a steward, you know, who'd clean your shoes and made your bed. And then you went down to the mess, which is another glorified Mission hut, which was sort of panelled and made up to be a wardroom. And that's where you ate and socialised at the bar in the evening, that sort of thing. And then you went up the hill to where the new blocks, the education blocks, had been built. And there were laboratories and workshops, all pretty new, big hangars full of... machinery that, you know, whole engines out of ships had been brought, whole steering gears, and for us, you know, there were umpteen engines on stands and airframes and all the rest of it. So there was a lot of stuff around. And but we spent most of our time in the, you know, the lecture halls.
Mm. What about flying, Dick? I mean, is that still in the background, or...?
No, it came very much to the foreground, because at the end of that time, all the time we'd been sort of trying to escape, you know, we didn't want to be down the engine room, so we decided to be aircraft engineers. Now we were aircraft engineers, and we'd been, you know, we'd been on the Eagle, we'd seen what the aircraft engineer did, and, you know, how he ran the maintenance in the hangar with all the mechanics. And now we were destined to go out and do that. In the nick of time, we were saved, because they said there was a requirement for maintenance test pilots, and they needed some engineers to become pilots in order to be marine scientists. And would any of us be interested in this? And my term then was about 12 people. And we all took one step forward. And then they had the job of sorting out 12 down to 3. And they sent us to the Air Medical School at Leon Solent, where they proceeded. I mean, we were all fit young men. We'd spent our whole time playing rugby and cross-country running and all the rest of it since we were 15. There was nothing wrong with any of us, but they had to find ways of, because you know, after all, we'd all passed the exams. There was no difference. Well, there probably was some difference intellectually, but that's not how they did it. You know, one poor guy got, he had flat feet. Well, what's that got to do with it? So he was, and so on. They went down, and then we had an elaborate eye test, you know, and somebody else was found to be colorblind. Well, it hadn't been shown up till then. So he was out, and in the end, there were three of us, and so we then were going to be taught to fly.
What about, I mean, reaction response, those kind of, were they
tested? Oh, the others were very miserable, because, I mean, our whole term wanted to go and learn. You know, this is the next exciting thing. We'd done all the hard work. Now, you know, they knew what they'd be doing from then on, but here was another unknown world, you know, which we were, you know.
I'm sorry, Dick, I didn't phrase it correctly. I meant in terms of your capacity to react to things quickly. Did they do any reaction? I mean,
oh, yes,
they
had
what
the
kind of test did they?
Yes, they had the all sorts of funny things, like a bit like there used to be things that you could learn to drive by looking at a screen, you know, and driving down a road. Well, they had those sort of things, you know, where you had to negotiate on a screen. I mean, it was a laugh looking back to it now, but then it was really high-tech stuff, and they had psychologists, Navy psychologists. Now, there's a thing.
And what kind of questions did they ask?
Are you afraid of, I don't know, probably afraid of heights, you know. It was all a joke as far as we were concerned. I mean, we just breezed through it. I think they only sorted people out physically. I don't think any of us were sorted out psychologically, I don't think. I can't remember any of the other tests. Oh, they put us in one of those chambers and evacuated the air and see when you started to do silly things. You know, you had to play chess or write notes or something, you know, and where you sort of started to wander off because lack of oxygen, that sort of thing. They did that. Yeah, all those sort of things. Yeah. But anyway, three of us then were sent to the RAF, to Syreston, which is near Nottingham. And that was the RAF then did the initial training for the Navy. So we went to Syreston, which was an initial training, flight training school. And we joined up with other Navy chaps who were going to be pilots. But they were straightforward Navy pilots. They weren't engineers like us. They'd done a short induction course to be officers, and then now they were there to learn. So we were all in a group of naval officers learning to fly. And the RAF did the training, and there was a naval liaison officer and a captain who commanded our little group. I mean, that must have been a soft number. We only saw him once a week. So we were there and, you know, went through the regular flying training.
Well, can you take me through that?
Yeah, it was on Piston Provost, which is you sat side by side with the instructor, and it was an Elvis Leonides piston engine, 550 horsepower. Quite a heavy aeroplane. I think it was a good idea. The idea was that you started off flying a heavy aeroplane. Instead of, as happened during the war, you started off with a Tiger Moth, which was like a little feather down thing, and then you had to make the transition to heavier ones. The thinking then was you started off with a heavy plane. So we started off with that. You did ground school for about half the time, you know, learning about meteorology, signalling. You had to do Morse all over again, radio telephony, theory of flight. Again, a sort of quite an academic course, and you had to pass that. And you then, and also at the same time, you were doing the flying training. And you I had, he was called John Merritt. There were two brothers, identical twins, I think they were, and they were both flying instructors. They would be Flight Lieutenant Aria, and John Merritt was mine. And on about the second day, I turned my aeroplane on its nose. He was saying, in those days, a lot of light signals on airfields, and the control tower would point an Aldous at you and shine a green or a red or a white. Depending on the situation, it meant various things, like traffic lights, really. And John said to me, when we're taxiing round, taxi round there to the takeoff point, and then we'll do the... Oh, and if they give you a red light from the control tower, you stop. So I'm taxiing along, and they give me a red light. So I stamp on the brakes too heavily, and the aircraft slowly... And he's going, oh, no, oh, no, sitting beside me. Because, once it started to tip, you can't stop it. And then the propeller goes, ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and bits of tarmac go in the air, and then it flops back down again onto its three wheels. Oh, dear. And so we then taxi, the engine's still running, and we go back to the dispersal, get out, and of course the propeller's bent. And that means that it's probably shot-loaded the engine, because every time the propeller dug the ground, it tried to sort of twist the crankshaft the other way. So it means the engine's got to come out. It's big, big stuff, big maintenance stuff. Then he has to go before a sort of John has to go to before an RAF disciplinary sort of court, and they sent him to be confined to barracks for a fortnight. He's a married man, and his wife lives in married quarters on the station. He can't go off the station now. I'm just told to, next time you apply the brakes, don't press so hard. And so then I had to confine myself to barracks, because every evening I had to go down to the bar with John and buy him drinks until he was satisfied. And then it was the time of the goons. And he and his brother they could harmonize very well. And he taught me the Ying Tong song, and he was also keen on the Everly Brothers. So, sweet, sweet, see that. So we used to do that. That's how we spent our evenings.
How old was he?
He was about my age. We were all about, 23 or something. Yeah, that's right. So, and then, of course, all the time we were still flying, of course, got another aeroplane. And, the flying progressed. Every now and again you'd have what was called a scrub check, which meant that you, the squadron commander, or even higher, would fly with you for one particular sorting. And you were very dry-mouthed about this, because if you failed, you were out. And so there was a lot of nervous apprehension. Was this just a routine trip with him to see how you're getting on? Or was it the scrub check? There was a lot of apprehension in the air all the time.
And when would you know if it was a scrub check or not?
Afterwards. As you were carrying your suitcase out the day.
Out the gate. Really?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, if you put up a real black, and then they said, the CO's going to fly with you tomorrow. You knew then, if you put up a black, you'd done something silly, and then you were going to have the check, that you would then know that that was the appraisal. In other words, your instructor probably said, well, I think he's hopeless, and then the CO would say, well, I'll fly with him and, countersign it or whatever. So that was going on, so people were leaving.
I know there was quite a wastage.
There was a wastage, yes, but not a very high one. We had a really nice chap called Brush with us. I think it was Brush. Anyway, he had difficulty in landing. Landing is the most difficult thing when you first learn to fly. Anybody can take off, because the aeroplane will take off on its own once you open the throttle. But he had difficulty landing, and he had a master pilot as an instructor. He was a Polish there were still all these poor guys from Poland who came over and fought for us, and they weren't officers, they were master pilots. Well, by then, you know, were pilots, and then the highest you could be as a non-commissioned officer was a master pilot. And that was the top of the tree of the non-commissioned officers. And he had this master pilot, and he couldn't land. And he'd either try and land below the ground, in which case the master pilot would take over, or he'd land far too high up. And this was the day. This was, you know, make or break day. You've got to do it right today, you know. And he was given careful briefings and all the rest of it. They come in to land, and he's far too high, and he's drifting sideways, and he stalls. And at the end of the runway, there was this little caravan with a Perspex dome, and a guy in there with a Aldous torch. And if two aircraft were coming into land at the same time, because we didn't have RT to the tower, strange in those days, he'd shine a red at you, and then it was up to you to get out of the way, because there was another plane either just below you or beside you or something. And this chap saw this aircraft right above him and just bolted from this little head, because the airplane just fell vertically onto the runway and just disintegrated into a kit. So there was the master pilot and our friend sitting in their seats with no cockpit sides. The engine had come off the front, both wings were off, the tail was off. It was just a heap of junk.
So there was no scrub check for
him? No, there was no scrub check for him, no. And later on, when we joined our first carrier, we were in Portsmouth, and he was given a minesweeper, and we went down, and he was captain of his minesweeper, and as happy as Larry. It was all well with anyone. So there were those exciting things going on.
But going back to these nuts and bolts of training to fly, cockpit drill, can you take us through the cockpit drill that you were on? This was the Provost, the first plane you flew.
Yes, Tafio was one of the things we learnt. You know, it's T-trim, T-throttle, that's the friction adjusted one. Altimeter, so you set that to ground level, if you like. Make so it read zero, and then check that the pressure indicator in the window was the actual air pressure for that day. Flaps are set, TAF. Fuel on and contents, you read the gauges. Eye instruments, you know, check, because by then you've got the master switch on and all the instruments should be erecting. You know, the gyro should have steadied, all the gauges on the engine should be live, although you haven't actually maybe started it at that stage. So that's the instruments. Oh, you'd have the radio on, you'd have the navigation aids on. O would be oxygen if you had any, but these airplanes didn't have any. Harness, H, Taffy Ho, and hood, the hood shut and locked. And that was the vital actions checklist. In actual fact, every airplane had a book, and each book had in it all the checks before takeoff. So you'd have a sort of printout of the takeoff checklist with you in the pocket of your flying overalls, and you would check all that as well. But Tafio was the vital actions. If you did those, the aeroplane would fly.
Did you find it difficult to get around this whole new area of flying?
Yes, that was, especially your first solo. When you're with the instructor, of course, it's like having daddy with you, you know, because if you get lost or you, what do I do next, you've got the man to ask. But when you go off on your first solo, you know, it's probably about after 10 or 11 hours in those days of flying dual. You do cross-country navigation with him, you do all sorts of unusual attitudes, you do a bit of aerobatics, you do fast flying, slow flying, emergency flying, all this sort of stuff. The idea being that if you do get into trouble on your first solo, you have already gone through all these manoeuvres. So the day occurs, you know it's going to happen. You know, you've done 9 hours. Bloggins has gone solo. Ooh, you know, Jeffrey's gone solo. Ooh, why haven't I gone solo? And then you come back from a detail one day, and you land and taxi round to take off again. And he says, that's it. And you open the hood, he gets out and puts his harness together and tightens it so it can't flail around inside the cockpit. And he gives you a wave, and then you shut the hood. You realise you're all on your own, and you taxi round to the takeoff point and do the checks about 5 times, and then wait. I can't remember whether I don't think it was radio. Then you wait until you see the next aircraft land, and then you look at the control tower, and they'll give you a green, which means you can taxi onto it. So you taxi onto the runway again. You run through the checks again, and then you realise that it's all yours, and this is the exciting moment. And you take off, and of course, as soon as it leaves the ground, it's just fantastic, you know. You know, you're doing it. But it's very routine, because he's drilled you hundreds of times. So you take off, climb straight ahead, 500 feet, turn left, climbing. Keep the climb going, keep the turn going. You level off, downwind, check that you're paralleling the runway but in the reverse direction, do your after takeoff checks, then you're flying down parallel with the runway, pre-landing checks, so you only finish one lot of checks, you're into another lot of checks, pre-landing checks, right, you're beam the end of the runway, turn, start a descending turn, you've sort of learnt what the settings should be, what pressure you should have, manifold pressure on the engine for any given maneuver, so you've, you know, set it to that. And if you do all these things, the thing virtually flies itself, so it's descending in a nice turn. All you've got to do is guide it, really, and then you've got it lined up for finals. Check again your undercarriage is down. In this case, the undercarriage didn't go up and down, but you would check undercarriage, you know, because your next aeroplane is going to have undercarriage that goes up and down, so already you're doing that, so the undercarriage done. And then hopefully you do a decent landing. And then you pull off the runway, and you're greeted by your instructor. Yeah, great moment.
And your first landing was on your own was good?
Good enough. Yes, good enough. I can't remember now, but it must have been good enough, because you then have to go to more training for that particular maneuver, and then you go on to night flying at night with him, and then
this is all in Cirencester. You stay
yes,
in the same place.
Yes, Sarston.
Sarston,
yeah,
sorry.
That's right. It's up near Newark in Nottinghamshire, and then you do bigger and bigger cross countries.
What about night flying, Dick? What was the training procedure for that?
It's like day flying, except. You used to have what's called a night flying meal, so you go to the mess, and instead of having your dinner, you had like breakfast, you know, bacon and eggs and beans and all these sort of things, fill you all up, and then it's completely different at night, you know, as you can imagine. You've got torches and the ground crew, you know, they're all, yeah, you've got torches, and it's all another world, another strange world. And you get into the plane, because you can't see anything much outside. And you do all the checks again, you start it up, and then you've got to follow the lights round to the takeoff point. And the lights down the runway, of course, and so you take off down those lights and lift off. And of course, as soon as you lift it off ahead of you, it's just completely black. Admittedly, when you first start night flying, it's very early in the night. Yeah, so the sun's only just set, so there is some light in the sky. Later on, it gets more real. It's take off at 10 o'clock at night, that sort of thing. and then you it's completely on the instruments, of course. You can look out, but I mean, you're actually flying on the instruments all the time. You've got to develop that scan, you know, so that you're looking at the rate of descent indicator, you're looking at the altimeter, you're looking at all the instruments, then you're back again to the artificial rise, make sure your wings are level, make sure you're going in the right direction. So you develop this scan, and so after a while it becomes, you don't even have to think about it. You know, you're just doing it.
How would they prepare you for that before you took off?
Oh, you have what's called the instrument trainer, which is a funny sort of plywood box. Again, organised by a master pilot, Polish master pilot, and it was called the YG machine. And you got into this sort of, it was a pretend aeroplane, you know, it was about the size of a sofa, and you got into it, it was made of plywood, and then you shut the cockpit cover, which was not transparent, you know, it was completely opaque, and then inside was a set of instruments. And a joystick and a rudder bar, so that you could do takeoffs and things onto a heading, and then you would fly this around. He could introduce, you know, changes to the instruments and that sort of thing. So you would, you know, climb it, and then you would level off at what he was talking to you in the headphones, you know, you'd say climb to 5,000 feet, you climb it to 5,000 feet, then you'd level off, and then you'd say set heading 350, and you set off that heading, and then you would have a map, and the navigation control would have various of the local radio beacons, and then you would basically fly from one radio beacon to the other, that sort of thing. So this was all instrument flying. You didn't do any other flying with this. It was a pretty basic, it would now be called a simulator.
And but did it work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's limitation. I mean, looking back on it, it's easy to see it was crude and ridiculous. But it was the best there was then. And so this did teach you developing this scan, and also the fact that you didn't fly by the seat of your pants. You didn't use any of the physical effects that your body felt with flying. You just believed the instruments. You know, you just did, even though you felt you were flying on your side, if the wing said you were level, you were level. That's something you've got to overcome very early, because you do get these weird effects due to the canals in your ears. That if you're turning and then stop, well, like blind man's buff, you spin somebody around, when they stop, they fall over because they think they're actually leaning the other way. So, you know, you've got to overcome that, and this trainer did that for you. So you did get a good instrument scan going.
And when you did your first night flight, you had an instructor with you. You didn't go straight.
Oh, yes, you didn't go. No, you went, I think, probably about five hours of flying with them. You know, not all continuously, an hour at a time. While you navigated at night, and then there's the business of finding an airfield at night when you come back. I mean, they did have in those days a visual beacon that flashed. It's Morse code identifier, so you'd see a beacon if the visibility was good, and you'd read its code, and then say, "Oh, you know, that's Syston." That gave you the general direction of the place, and then of course you had to orientate yourself whichever runway they were using and the rest of it. The trick gets there when it's bad weather, of course, and you can't see this beacon, and you've got to find your way there electronically.
And electronically then would have meant?
Oh, very crude. It was the radio beacon, and you knew that when you got to the beacon, there would be then a pattern to fly from the beacon to the airfield, you know, like 5 minutes on this heading, and then a rate one turn, which is a graduated turn in a certain direction, and then you should be lined up with that runway, or a turn when you get to the beacon this way, and then line up. So it was pretty, it wasn't accurate, but you did it as accurately as you could, and that's all you had. But I mean, in those days, you thought that was, you know, the way it should be done. You know, things have developed rapidly since then.